Hello, time travelers, and welcome back to Biblical Time Machine. I am one of your hosts, Dave Roos. I am a journalist. I am here with my wonderful co-host, Helen Bond, professor of Christian origins at the University of Edinburgh. Today, I love this topic. I mean, I don't want to have anything to do with leprosy, but I have been super curious about what are we talking about when we talk about leprosy in the ancient world. We have a terrific guest. I feel very lucky to have found him because he is both a medical doctor and a scholar of biblical history. So, Helen, I think we really scored on this one.
Yeah, I know, exactly. He's the perfect person. So he's not dabbling with all of this. He actually knows the stuff. And yeah, no, leprosy is so interesting. And it's not what you think. I mean, that's the amazing thing, isn't it? It's not what you think. It's sort of not really very much at all. And it's, absolutely fascinating how leprosy becomes such a big deal in the Levitical texts and then the Gospels. And a very interesting conversation.
Yeah, some of the themes that we talk about today have come up with other guests, with Matt Thiessen, and when we talked about with Jody Magnus about mikvahs and sort of ritual purity in the ancient world. I think we bring a lot of ideas now that we have of kind of infection and infectious disease and how do you be clean and stuff like that. But this was, we got to get in the minds of the first century. This is not kind of what they were concerned with, was it?
No, I mean, this whole idea of sort of purity and impure is just kind of a different worldview than ours. And I think it's really interesting and really important to keep stressing to ourselves that people did look at the world in a different way. They look at disease, they look at other people in such a different way that we can't just assume that the way we see things is the way they did too.
So our guest is Dr. Ricky Shinall. He's a board-certified surgeon and an associate professor of surgery and medicine at Vanderbilt University. And he also received a Master of Divinity and a PhD in religion from Vanderbilt, making him, like we said, uniquely qualified for today's topic. I found Ricky because he wrote a great article on Bible Odyssey, our content partner, called Skin Disease and Social Exclusion. So we will put a link up to that if you want to learn more. And now's the time when we give away another copy of the SBL Study Bible. We're going to give away two copies again this week because we're crazy. Our winners are Michelle Tashman and Will Glasgow. Congratulations to you two. If you want to be like Michelle and Will, all you got to do is join the Time Travelers Club. That is our Patreon account where you can help support the show. So become a patron and get in the running for an SBL Study Bible. Also, in the next couple of weeks, we're going to be giving away one free pass to the four-day SBL Global Virtual Meeting. So if you want to get a free pass to that amazing assembly of biblical scholars in which we will be presenting something, another tease, get your name in the running today. But for now, let's get to our conversation with Dr. Ricky Shinall about leprosy in the ancient world. Well, Dr. Ricky Shinall, welcome to Biblical Time Machine.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm glad to be here.
All right. Today, when we talk about leprosy, it is also Hansen's disease. It's this very specific diagnosis. Just maybe tell us a little bit about Hansen's disease. Like what are the symptoms? How is it spread? It seems terrible. What is that like?
Certainly. Well, I'll put in the caveat that not only is this not a disease that I treat, it's not a disease that I've ever seen. It's thankfully very rare in the United States now. So I can tell you what I have learned about it. So it's an infectious disease. It's caused by what's called a mycobacterium, called Mycobacterium leprae. And the sort of most obvious manifestation of getting this infection is having skin lesions. So some of the areas of the skin lose their pigmentation and become white. Some of them become red or dark. And this can happen in just a few places or all over the person's body. And the really devastating aspect of this disease is, in addition to affecting the skin, it also affects the nerves. And over enough time will cause damage to both the motor nerves that give innervation to our muscles, but also the sensory nerves that let us feel in our skin. Mm. And this causes the sort of disfigurement that you imagine going along with this disease. So when the nerves get damaged, they can cause contractures where limbs are you know, hands or feet are sort of gnarled or shortened because the muscles are damaged. Can affect the muscles in the face, and so it causes coarsening of facial features and people sort of not looking like they had in the past. And because you lose sensation, especially in your sort of fingertips and your toes and your feet, you can get sort of chronic wounds because you're constantly getting little damage that we would normally sort of move our hands or move our feet, you know, getting burns, that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. And so this can eventually lead to loss of fingertips, toes. And that's sort of the idea of people's like hands and, you know, fingers falling off. Mm. That's sort of where it comes from with leprosy. So it's not exactly that that their hands just fall off. It's they have these wounds and damage right. over time. We're not exactly sure how it's spread. It is probably spread, person to person by breathing. Although it can, in the Southwest United States, we think that armadillos may actually carry it too, and you can get it from armadillos. So, although it's contagious, it's not highly contagious. So it seems like you need prolonged personal contact. So this is not like COVID where you're worried about sort of walking into a room and getting it. It seems to be that people have to be much closer for longer, to spread. And thankfully, it is rare now because it is treatable by antibiotics. Okay. So after the development of antibiotics, if you're diagnosed with it, but and it is treated before it damages your nerves and causes contractures or your facial features or wounds to develop, then it can be treated with a prolonged course of antibiotics. Mm-hmm. That's the modern disease that we call leprosy that has this eponym Hansen's disease. And we'll get into this, but one of the notable things is because of the damage that it does, you can actually detect it in human remains. And so, again, I'm also not a pathologist, but my understanding is archaeologists and pathologists have been able to tell from human remains whether someone has had Hansen's disease in the past. And as best we can tell, it doesn't seem like Hansen's disease really existed in the ancient Near East until about the turn of the era. Mm-hmm. So looking around, the first century of the Christian era, thereabouts is when we start to see human remains that show evidence of this disease.
So what we have in the New Testament then, that's not Hansen's disease. That's not what we would call leprosy. So
it's what is very unlikely.
What is it? Is it, yeah. is it some other, I mean, I've always heard people say sort of, a range of minor skin diseases, scurvy and stuff like right. that. Or, I mean, what do we think it is?
Right. So really to answer that question, we have to go back to Leviticus where mm-hmm. we start to get the description of what this thing that we translate leprosy in Hebrew, it's sarat. In Greek, it's lepra, and so we've translated that as leprosy. And as I said, Hansen's disease did not exist in the ancient Near East at the time that Leviticus was written. So whatever Leviticus is talking about, it's not talking about Hansen's disease. And so in Leviticus 13 gives a pretty extensive description for priests of how to recognize if someone has this leprosy. And really the sort of main feature is the white spots on the skin, the loss of pigmentation. But there's a lot of sort of, well, if it has to be this deep or this long, or if it's this and that, all the sorts of things. But basically what it comes down to is white spots on the skin. And so looking at the description, it probably doesn't match up to just one of our modern disease concepts. So, as I read it, I could certainly imagine things, dermatologic conditions like vitiligo or psoriasis, certainly some other infectious diseases that cause, skin rashes where you lose pigmentation, potentially vitamin or mineral deficiencies, like you mentioned, scurvy, those kind of things, other sort of autoimmune issues. So it's really not clear that there's one thing that this is. in terms of the way that we would think about diseases. And so you really just kind of have to take it as a kind of native concept to this culture and say, okay, this is leprosy, these things that cause some degree of whiteness in your skin, without trying to say exactly, oh, this person has this disease that we would name it, and this person has this disease as we would name it.
Yeah. Well, but I just, okay, well, I do want to clarify, because you said that we do sort of find remains in the first century of people with Hansen's disease. So, you know, like you said, Leviticus times, this was not Hansen's disease, but it was maybe possible that if we're talking about New Testament, you know, period, that there were people maybe that had, you know, what we call leprosy today, possibly.
It certainly is possible. Mm. I would say that in terms of reading like descriptions of people of that are called leprous in ancient documents, especially ancient Jewish or Christian documents, it's several centuries later before you start seeing like real descriptions of like, oh yeah, that sounds like Hansen's disease, okay. Right? So for instance, you know, Basil of Caesarea, who's in the fourth century, has a hospital, and his funeral eulogy mentions people with leprosy being received there, and it's very sort of graphically describing deformity and loss of facial features and stuff like that, and says, okay, that sounds like Hansen's disease. You know, in the material that we have from the New Testament and other sort of contemporaneous literature, you don't have that degree of detail to say, okay, this is starting to sound more like Hansen's disease. So it certainly could be, but it's not necessarily suggested that you have to think of it like as Hansen's disease when you're in the New Testament times.
Okay.
Cool. Yeah. I think for some listeners, that's going to be quite a revelation, really, that it's not what we call as leprosy. So if we jump in our time machine, then get to the controls, go back to the first century. The temple is still standing then in the time of Jesus. And there's this strange thing about people with leprosy or lepra, whatever this is, not being able to go into the temple, isn't there, because of ritual impurity. Can you talk us through that? I mean, what, especially if it's not Hansen's disease, what's so bad about someone with scurvy going into the temple?
Right. So this really comes down to purity itself, right? So, you know, we're outside of that culture, and it's a little bit hard for us to intuit why did the authors of Leviticus or God say that these things are clean and these things are unclean. But it's very clear that that the things that are designated unclean, it is very, very bad for those to have contact with things that go into the temple and into God's presence. And so, you know, certainly it would be a fair inference that people with leprosy couldn't go into the temple. I mean, they're clearly unclean, and there's a lot of material from Leviticus on about the dangers of the contact between the unclean and the divine. But it's a little bit less clear what else they couldn't do or what they could do in that time.
Yeah. We're going to get into that, because that's the sort of the crux of your research is, you know, yes, we have ritual impurity, but does that mean that these people are actual, you know, pariahs within the wider culture? But while we're talking about the temple and ritual impurity, we had a guest a while ago, Matt Thiessen, and he, you know, he's written a lot about ritual impurity, and he was making the point, and I think you were alluding to this, you know, when you're in this culture, you have these ideas of clean and unclean, ritually pure, ritually impure, but that is not the same as like sinful, right? It's not the same as something as bad. It was just that most of the days of the week you were walking around and you were ritually impure. If you didn't need to go to the temple, it was no big deal. However, it's not hard to read, you know, Old Testament stories in particular where, you know, God kind of punishes somebody for doing something, you know, bad by giving them, you know, what they call leprosy. So do we think, you know, compared to the other things that would make somebody ritually impure, like discharges and or sexual contact, was leprosy, did it have something more attached to it? Was it somehow worse than these other things? Was there like a moral judgment upon these people?
Yeah, so I think Leviticus doesn't explicitly say this impurity is worse than this impurity. Mm. You know, there's just, they're sort of clean and unclean. However, certainly when you look at Leviticus's description of what it takes for someone who has leprosy, the leprosy is healed, then to become clean again, that is much more extensive than these other sorts of sources of impurity. Whereas when you remove the impurity, you can basically wash, and then at sundown, you're ritually clean again. With leprosy, it's you have to get a priest. It's this multi-stage process of purification and sacrifice, and takes, you know, over a week to do. So the regaining cleanliness from leprosy is much more extensive than the other things, which would seem to imply that it's of a degree higher. Also, Leviticus explicitly talks about people with leprosy needing to be outside of the camp. Right. So remember, the situation in Leviticus is that the Israelites are on the move from Egypt to the promised land. So they're living in a camp. And when Leviticus talks about people with leprosy, the people with leprosy need to be outside of that camp, which is not the case for all the other sources of impurity. So in those aspects, leprosy is sort of more extensively impure, if you want to take that implication, than these other sources of impurity, even though Leviticus doesn't explicitly say this is the order and this is worse than this. I think if you look at the narrative materials about leprosy, I think you're right. There is, in some stories, very much a valence of leprosy being a divine punishment, but that's not always the case. And it may be worth, at this point in the conversation, to just kind of go over those stories, because we'll probably refer to them a number of times about leprosy. So if you think about in the Hebrew Bible, the people that had leprosy, the stories about people with leprosy, there's actually not that many of them. So one story is Moses himself. So if you remember, when Moses set the burning bush, Moses is really trying to weasel out of of doing what God tells him to do, and saying all these things about, well, they won't believe me, and I can't do this. So God gives him a number of miraculous signs that he can do to convince people that he has really been sent from God and that he should tell Pharaoh to let the people go. One of which is that Moses puts his hand in his cloak, it comes out and it has leprosy, and then he puts it back in his cloak and it doesn't have leprosy anymore. So that's not about punishment, but it's certainly about God doing something and using leprosy and its resolution as a sign of God's power. Later on in the story, by the time we get to the book of Numbers, when the people are free, Moses's brother and sister Aaron and Miriam kind of grumble against him, and in punishment for that, God strikes Miriam with leprosy, and then Moses prays for Miriam's leprosy to be removed, and it is. So there you have a story where this certainly is about punishment. But it's also about how Moses, being in connection with God, can affect the cure of the leprosy. Really, the other stories of people with leprosy come from 2 Kings. So there's the story of, probably the most famous story of someone with leprosy, is Naaman the Syrian, who's this general in the service of the king of Aram. So a foreigner who has leprosy, and he just has it. It's not, there's no indication that it's divine punishment. He has it. He doesn't like it, but it hadn't stopped him from becoming, you know, a general and being in the company of kings. And so he hears that there's a holy man in the northern kingdom of Israel, Elisha, who could heal him. And so he goes, and Elisha eventually has him healed, has him bathe in the River Jordan, and his leprosy is healed, and the leprosy goes away. And so again, not a punishment, but revealing God's power and the holy man's power to remove leprosy. In that same story, Elisha's servant Gehazi then tries to swindle Naaman out of some money as a payment that Gehazi intends to pocket for himself for the cure. which is not a smart thing to do when you work for a profit, because Alicia is able to know that he does this and says, well, guess what? Now you get Naaman's leprosy. Oh, so now Gehazi has irony. Naaman's leprosy. Mm. Yeah. So there you do have a punishment.
Okay.
A leprosy as a punishment. But again, it's also sort of showing Elisha's power as God's representative to say who gets the leprosy cured and who gets leprosy inflicted. Another, a little bit later in 2 Kings, the Arameans besiege the northern kingdom of Israel and its capital, Samaria. And God delivers the kingdom by inciting a panic in the besieging army such that they flee in the middle of the night but leave all their stuff there. So there's this besieged city that has been saved, but they don't know it because the camp, you know, the army, the besieged camp, besieging camp is still all around it. And so outside of Samaria are some people with leprosy who say, you know what, we're outside the walls, we got nothing to lose, why don't we go to the Arameans and see if we can get mercy before they come in and slaughter everybody in the city or before everybody starves. So they go and they discover that the camp is empty and deserted, and they announce it to the city, and the city rejoices, the siege has been lifted. So again, there is a story where there's no punishment, they just have leprosy. There's no indication that they're punished. There's no cure of leprosy. That's just, it's part of the story. And then finally, even later in 2 Kings, there's a story of a king of Judah whose name is Azariah. It's also in 2 Chronicles. His name is Uzziah, but it's the same guy, who is a king in Jerusalem who has leprosy inflicted on him by God because he tries to usurp some priestly functions in terms of doing sacrifice. And then God inflicts leprosy on him, and he has to live outside the palace, and his son rules as his regent. So that's a long way of answering that question. But you see, yes, there are some stories where leprosy is indeed a punishment from God. So Miriam, Uzziah, Gehazi. But there are really just as many stories where it's not a punishment, where someone just has leprosy and they didn't do anything wrong to get it. But a lot of those stories have to do with God's being the one that controls leprosy. That it's sort of a distinctive power of the God of Israel to be able to inflict and cure leprosy. Both of the God of Israel and the God of Israel's agents, like Moses and Elisha.
So that it makes sense in, once we get to the New Testament, you know, it makes sense that Jesus would be healing people with leprosy. I think that would have a lot of meaning to people already familiar with the Old Testament. Like you said, if the God of Israel is the one that can inflict or heal people with leprosy, then if Jesus has that same power, that makes that explicit connection that he is, you know, like you said, God's agent in the world.
And he makes that almost explicit in Matthew and Luke, where John the Baptist sends his disciples to Jesus and asks, you know, are you the one I've been waiting for, or are we to wait for another? And Jesus, in typical Jesus fashion, doesn't give him a straight answer. It gives him this sort of cryptic answer of, you know, the blind see, those who can't walk. And one of the examples is people with leprosy are cleansed.
Okay.
So again, that this is Jesus himself uses it as sort of a authentication and validation of his ministry as his response to John the Baptist's question of who are you?
Okay. Well, all right. If you go back to, like you said, Leviticus, it's to talk about a camp. Very clearly in Leviticus, you know, God says people with leprosy have to hang out outside of the camp. This kind of has echoes in other texts, right? Like, is it pretty common that people with leprosy are going to be separated from the rest of the culture? Do they have to live, like, outside of the city walls of Jerusalem? And do they always have to be separate? And do we think that they understood on some level that this was infectious and that's why they had to be separated? Anyway, those are several questions, but what do you think?
Right. So I think that's the main question. And that's really the question that in my article I was trying to get at. Mm. And I think the short answer to that is we don't know. Mm. So in terms of the infectious issue, there's only one document from this milieu that I was able to find that that has any indication that leprosy, that this thing that they called leprosy, is contagious. There's a fragmentary gospel called the Edgerton Gospel that has basically the same story of Jesus healing the person with leprosy that's in Matthew, Mark, and Luke. But in that version, he talks about he got it because he was traveling in an inn and some people with leprosy were there, and that's how he got his leprosy. But that's the only document that I've been able to find that indicates that this condition is transmissible. So I don't think that there's exclusion because of the fears of transmission. And even in that story, they're in an inn together, right? So you know, they go to a public place. He's in a public place with them, and they're there together. I think the question, so really the question is about, okay, given that Leviticus says that these people need to be removed from the camp, what do you do with them when you don't live in the camp anymore? Mm-hmm. And that's really the crux, is how do you interpret Leviticus when you are not in the Exodus situation, living in a camp with a tabernacle and moving all the time? And you can sort of imagine a number of ways of interpreting that, right? I mean, this is how we all, you know, from time immemorial, we've interpreted the Bible as you know, under different circumstances, and maybe saying, well, this doesn't apply at all, or this applies in this way or that. I think one very consistent thing that we see is there does seem to be a sense that people with leprosy can't be in Jerusalem. And that would make sense if you think of the issue with the camp is, well, the camp is where the tabernacle is, and therefore the people with leprosy need to be separated from that. Well, the corresponding thing, once you don't live in the camp anymore, is the city with the temple in it. And so that would make sense. And so, you know, in that story of King Uzziah, from 2 Kings and 2 Chronicles, he gets leprosy and he has to move somewhere else outside the palace. You know, certainly Josephus, who's a first century Jewish historian.
Another good friend of the podcast. We know him well.
Yeah. talks about people with leprosy not being able to go into Jerusalem. The authors of the Dead Sea Scrolls, in one of their documents called the Temple Scroll, which is this sort of their imagination of what the rules should be in Jerusalem, talk about needing a sort of separate place for people with leprosy to live. So certainly, you know, I think it's the preponderance of the evidence over time seems to be that, okay, Jerusalem or the temple or maybe Jerusalem as a whole is sort of a no-go area for people with leprosy. I think really the question is, what were there other no-go areas? Was this sort of every city? So again, in that story of the siege of Samaria, you have the people with leprosy living outside the city walls. So they're outside the city. But they also talk about they could go into the city and seek shelter, but they don't because everyone in the city is starving. And so they present it as a live option of going into Samaria, which would indicate that, you know, maybe in some situations, like when you're being besieged, you can relax whatever restrictions you have. And so maybe it's cities that you have to be outside of, but you know, a lot of people don't live in cities. So is it villages too? If it's a village and it's not, you know, doesn't have a wall, how far outside, how far away? So there's all these interpretive questions that we don't really have a lot of documentary evidence of saying, like, well, this is how far outside they, you know, this is the proscribed zone and how far away you have to be. Especially when we start looking at the New Testament stories, which are happening, you know, in Galilee and not in Jerusalem.
Yeah, I was just going to ask about that. I mean, you know, and I think that's, you know, this picture you're painting is really interesting, particularly to people like me who were brought up on Ben-Hur. You know, whole idea of leprosy is those poor family members who have to sort of huddle together outside the city. So, but yeah, I was thinking, I mean, in the New Testament where you've got Jesus seems to sort of come across them. I mean, we don't get many details where they are, but it feels as though they're somehow sort of coming in contact with him, and you know, he's not seeking them out in strange places.
Right. I mean, there's a story that's repeated in Matthew, Mark, and Luke of Jesus healing a person with leprosy by touching him and saying, you know, I will your leprosy to be cleansed. And it's interesting where they said it. In Mark, it's while Jesus is going through Galilee and preaching in the synagogue. So it doesn't really concretely tell you where it is and when it happens, but it's in that milieu where Jesus is like amongst people. In Matthew, it's the first thing that happens when Jesus comes down from the Sermon on the Mount. Like literally the verse before is talking about the crowds following him down from the mountain. And then there's this person with leprosy. And there's nothing in Matthew of the crowd gasping that this person with leprosy is there or that Jesus would touch him. It's just sort of there and it happens. And then in Luke, the story happens in a city. It's just Jesus was in the city. There's this person with leprosy in the city. They encounter each other. And there's no explanation that the person with leprosy snuck into the city or anything. It's just Jesus and the person with leprosy are just there in the city together. And then in Matthew and Mark, when we get to Holy Week and Jesus is staying in Bethany where he gets anointed, they describe the place that where they're having this dinner party is the house of Simon the leper.
Yeah. Ex-leper or
right, not right. I mean it doesn't say Simon the ex-leper or Simon the person who Jesus cured his leprosy. Right, exactly. It just says Simon the leper without any comment on it. And so from just the text of the New Testament itself, there's not really any indication that these people are set apart or that there's any sort of bar to social contact with them. To make that reading, you really need to bring in that as sort of background. And really one of the points I was trying to make with the article I wrote is that the background's not all as clear as that we think it is, is that it's not as univocal that these people are excluded from all of these social situations. And so I think really we're unfortunately ignorant of the exact social location of people with leprosy in Jesus's time in the Galilee.
Well, and yeah, so if it's not clear that they were socially separated, something that Jesus does that I feel like we make a big deal about is that he touches, right? He touches the leper to heal them. So is that anywhere in Leviticus or other texts, like, you're not supposed to touch lepers? Is that a big taboo?
So, short answer, no. Hmm. I think you're right. That does become a big point that people make in these interpretations, that this is a big deal that Jesus touched this person, that this was transgressing some sort of taboo and showing that Jesus is not bound by these taboos. So one thing about the touching is Jesus heals a lot of people by touching. And so do other ancient wonder workers. This is a primary mode of the transmission of whatever power that healers have is often done by touch. And it's done in several of the other miracle stories of Jesus where he heals someone by touch. So the fact that detail's there doesn't have to be about anything having to do with cleanliness, uncleanliness, that kind of stuff. I think when we look at the Levitical legislation, it is interesting that Leviticus 13 and 14, where it talks about leprosy, doesn't say anything about the uncleanliness of people with leprosy being transmitted to people who touch them, okay. which is an interesting silence, given that several of the other forms of impurity, Leviticus is explicit about if you touch someone with this, then you become impure, and then you have to, or if they touch an object, that object becomes impure.
Oh. Yeah, menstruating women, there's loads,
right,
isn't
yeah,
there?
Yeah, yeah, exactly. So it's also interesting because chapter 14 is really almost all about how the priest determines that the person with leprosy no longer has leprosy anymore, that the leprosy has been resolved, which means that a priest would have to get pretty close to someone who may or may not still have leprosy and examine them. And I would imagine that there's a high risk that they will touch that person. And if there's anybody that should really care about their state of ritual purity and have a really good idea of if they're in a state of ritual purity or not, it's a priest. Mm. And so it's really kind of amazing to me that Leviticus is silent on this. And that may be that just that part of the priestly code or legislation didn't get preserved in Leviticus or whatever.
But they made sure to get all the menstruating women. You can't skip any of those, but leprosy.
Right. So it is striking. Now, I will say, when we start to see in the rabbinic literature the kind of a fuller interpretation and sort of going interpretation of the rules, the rabbinic literature, which is again several centuries after the time of the New Testament, does see leprosy as transmitting impurity both by touch and by what's called overhang. So like by being in the same enclosed space.
Overhang.
Really, the sort of underlying logic there is one of analogy. So I talked about how, in some ways, leprosy seems to be have these sort of more extensive purification rituals and require more separation. And so the rabbis, it seems what they did is they sort of said, well, there must be a hierarchy of impurities. Leprosy must sit at the top, and therefore it must be as defiling as, at least as defiling as anything else. And so it sort of fills in the gaps in Leviticus and says, well, it must transmit impurity by touch and by overhang because these other things that seem to be less defiling do as well. But that's, again, that's an interpretation of Leviticus. It's an interpretation, the evidence of which we have after the time of Jesus. It's certainly possible that people thought of it that way, but we don't have a lot of evidence, contemporary with or earlier than Jesus, talking about the impurity of people with leprosy being transmitted by touch. Mm-hmm. So to get back to those stories, I think that's just an overread of those stories. It's possible that people thought that leprosy transmitted impurity. But if so, then you're back to that same issue of like, well, how much do people care about contracting impurity? Right. I mean, and how big a deal would it be to touch someone with leprosy versus a menstruating woman, someone who had had sex recently, someone, who had, any of the other things that make that give you sort of transmissible impurity. So I don't see any reason to read those stories as Jesus doing anything remarkable by touching the person with leprosy, except for the fact that by touching them, he heals the leprosy, which is remarkable.
Oh, wow. That's an interesting way to read that. So, I mean, you mentioned the priests a little while ago, and in that first account, well, in fact, I think it's the only account in Mark's gospel, isn't it, where Jesus heals and touches the man with leprosy. Afterwards, he has this sort of complicated thing about go to the priests, show yourself, and of course the man disobeys and just runs off because he's fully healed. But what do you think that little thing is doing there? I mean, clearly Jesus is telling the man to follow Levitical principle, but why only there as well?
Well, I think one thing is, I mean, this is really the only miracle story that's really about healing something that is a source of impurity, right? Other miracle stories, you can kind of like maybe read that in, like the woman with the flow of blood, if you assume that it's gynecological and all this kind of stuff, but it's not sort of explicitly about
that. That's
true.
We're not told, are we?
Yeah. But in this case, you are dealing with something that is a disease process, which is, clearly a source of uncleanliness and which requires a fairly extensive purification ritual once it's resolved. And so, I think it's there because Jesus is enmeshed in this system and he's part of this culture and he's not overturning Levitical purity regulations. And so having healed this person, he wants him to be able to, do all the things that he is entitled to, once he is sort of officially rendered, ritually pure, ritually clean, again. I think it's interesting in Mark's gospel, as you said, Jesus tells him this and the guy ignores it and goes off and tells everybody.
He tells him two things. He's like, don't tell anybody I did this. and then go to the priest, and he leaps up, he screams, "And Jesus just healed me!" And
Well, and I think I love that guy. I think it's also interesting in that he seems to be successful at that, even and which means he's having social contact with people, even though he hasn't undergone the purification rituals again. So again, there's a question of how much of a bar to social contact was this if this guy's able to be a successful evangelist without undergoing the proper purification rituals beforehand.
Mm-hmm. Well, all right. So we don't delve into interpretation a ton on here. We try to stick to the facts as much as possible. But I think is an important point that you make in your article that, you know, the traditional interpretation of Jesus healing these lepers and by touching them, like we could talk about, well, you know, in the Jewish society, these people were pariahs, they were outcasts, they would not, you know, they were untouchable. Maybe we could even use that word. But Jesus sort of broke those taboos. He's fulfilling sort of the law in other ways, but he's kind of superseding it. He's kind of better or more than, you know, the priests and their powers. Why do you think this is kind of a dangerous interpretation?
So I really think that this is a sort of example of a larger family of interpretations that I will describe as Jesus is good because Jews are bad. Yeah. And I think that's why it's dangerous. Yeah. It is that it is really stretching the evidence, as I argue, more than the evidence really supports to create a picture of kind of ostracism and social exclusion and really victimization of people by Jesus's society that Jesus is able to overcome by doing something that kind of feels good to us as 21st century, you know, liberal with a capital L, like, you know, having the full tradition of modernity of sort of greater social inclusion and sort of disdain for traditional taboos that sort of separate or hierarchies that separate people. And so it feels very good for us to say, oh, Jesus is like us. He would see a system like that as, you know, hopelessly primitive and backwards and against God's will. Mm-hmm. And therefore would flout it and bring inclusion to this person who this terrible society is excluding. And the problem with that is, one is I don't think it's accurate, but the moral problem with that is the terrible society that you're talking about is Jewish people. Mm. And unfortunately, when we talk about ancient Jewish people, that tends to be translated to also contemporary Jewish people, right? So it's this weird thing where, you know, when we talk about the wicked Egyptians in the Bible, no one applies that to people who live in Cairo today. But when you start talking about Jews in the Bible, you know, that bleeds into the way that we think about Jewish people today. And so I think we need to be very careful when we have New Testament interpretations that really depend on, in some sense, the awfulness of an aspect of Second Temple Judaism. And I think if you're going to propound those sort of interpretations, then the burden of proof really needs to be on you that this awfulness really did exist. And I just don't think the evidence shows that. You know, I think the evidence is fragmentary and spread over centuries, of how these people were treated in the various societies from, you know, Leviticus onwards. And we really just don't have enough to say that these people were in some sort of state of wretched isolation. And I don't think it's fair to either Jesus's contemporaries or Jews today to say that they were based on the evidence that we have.
Mm. Yeah, really good point. So, Ricky, we have a bonus question. Are you ready for this? So,
certainly.
We have a fully functioning time machine, don't we, Dave? We really do.
Most of the time.
Yeah, it can be a little bit dodgy sometimes, but most of the time it gets you back. It's coming back that's the problem. So, when and where do you want to go?
Well, so I will say one of the things that I have learned as a student of history is that I do not want to live in history. So I only would want
We've
to.
We've realized that it's, too.
it seems like a very bad place.
Yeah.
And so this is not the most exciting answer, but I have three young children, the oldest of whom is five. So I would like to go to that day in the future where no one in my house cries for a full 24 hours.
You know what? You'll be missing it. By that time, you'll be missing it.
Missing it is a strong.
So sweet. Sweet when you were little.
They are very sweet. The cry. I forget about the crying, but I will tell you, I am speaking, I'm speaking from your future. And it is a good place when they're like, they're in their early teens and they're fun and they hang out and you can do stuff with them and they don't cry nearly as much. All right. Your future is good. You'll be there before you know it. All right. Well, thank you so much, Ricky. This has been fascinating. Thank you, Helen. Thank you, listeners. And we will see all of you on the next episode of Biblical Time Machine. Bye. Okay, time travelers, we have one more exciting announcement. Thanks for listening all the way to the end of the podcast. Only you get to hear this cool news. We have opened a Biblical Time Machine online store. Yes, you can finally go buy your Biblical Time Machine swag. Fine. Okay, there's only one physical item you can buy. There is a mug with our name on it, with our logo on it. But even better than that, Helen and I have put together a four-part audio study guide to the Gospel of Mark. It's called The Gospel of Mark as an Ancient Biography. So this is something we're not going to be doing regular podcast episodes about, but it's something that you can go and download in our store. All you got to do is go to biblicaltimemachine.com, click on the store button, and the rest is pretty self-explanatory. You buy it, you download it, you listen to it. It comes with study questions for personal study or group discussions. So go check it out. We're very excited. There's going to be more stuff in the Biblical Time Machine store soon. But until then, we'll see you next time. Bye.